They were all in Suffolk, now. Anthony had no orthodox faith, but he liked the look and feel of churches, the dignities and absurdities of ritual, the shy belonging of English Anglican congregations. He had known his own village church all his life. It was as old as the rabbi in Browning's poem, even if no longer quite in its original form, and it was wide and light and welcoming, with clear glass windows and a marvellous small modern bronze sculpture of Noah releasing the dove to commemorate the first performance there of Benjamin Britten's church opera, Noah's Flood. That had been in 1958, when Anthony was 11. He had heard all the church operas there, sitting through them, dressed in his school grey flannel shorts and a tie, as a mark of respect to the music and to the composer. It was where he had first heard Curlew River, which remained his favourite, long before he had dared to put drawing at the heart of his life, long before birds became a passion. It was the building where he had first become aware of the profound importance of creativity, and thus it was natural that he should want his sons to go through the great rites of life's passage there too, wasn't it? They had all been christened there, Edward and Ralph and Luke. Anthony might have preferred some simple humanist naming ceremony, but Rachel had wanted them christened in the church, baptized from the ancient and charming font, and she had wanted it quite forcefully. "They don't have to stay Christian," she'd said to Anthony over her shoulder, as always occupied with something. "But at least they have the option, is what you had. Why shouldn't they have what you had?" The christenings had been lovely, of course, and moving, and Anthony's sense of profound association with the church building had grown deeper with each one. So intense was his assumption that that was where the boys would marry, when, if they married, that he was startled when his eldest, Edward, appeared with an elegant and determined young Swede, and announced that they were to be married, and, naturally, from her home, not his. His fiancée, a laboratory researcher into the analysis of materials for museums and galleries, had been well briefed. She drew Anthony aside and fixed her astonishing light blue gaze on him. "You needn't worry," Sigrid said in her perfect English. "It will be a humanist ceremony. You will feel quite at home." The wedding of Edward and Sigrid had taken place at her parents' summer house on some anonymous island in the archipelago outside Stockholm, and they had eaten crayfish afterwards, wearing huge paper bibs, mountains and mountains of crayfish, and aquavit had flowed like a fatal river, and it never got dark. The morning after the wedding, Sigrid had taken Ed away in a boat, not to return. Anthony and Rachel were left marooned among Sigrid's family and friends, under a cloudless sky and entirely surrounded by water. They'd held hands, Anthony recalled, on the flight home, and Rachel had said, looking away from him, out of the aeroplane window, "Some situations are just too foreign to react to, aren't they?" Well, that was over 11 years ago now, almost 12. And there, below the chancel steps, sat Mariella, Edward and Sigrid's 8-year-old daughter, her ballet-slippered feet tucked under her pink skirts, her hair held off her face by an Alice band of rosebuds. Anthony tried to catch her eye, his only granddaughter, his grave, self-possessed granddaughter, who spoke English and Swedish and played the cello. By the merest movement of her head, Mariella indicated that she was aware of him, but she wouldn't look his way. Her job that day, her mother had said, was to set a good example to the other little bridesmaids, all Charlotte's nieces, and Mariella's life was largely dedicated to securing her mother's good opinion. She knew she had her grandfather's, whatever she did, as a matter of course. "Concentrate," Rachel hissed. He snapped to attention. "Sorry. I'm delighted to announce..."